Alright, I'm just going to drop myself onto AutoVox here, and we will start, and we'll talk about any problems that people might be having, and if for some reason you don't want your stuff on the recording, if you could just let me know, and I will take it off the recording, although we would like to stress the fact that the stuff that you might not feel too happy about that you're having trouble with is probably something that about six other students aren't feeling happy about either and would love the assistance with. I don't know whether that's meant to make people feel any better, but one would hope that that would be the case, and we try not to pick on anybody who's having trouble with stuff, because this is complex stuff. The exploration is one of the tougher networking courses. This is not discovery. Look, Mummy, I just bought a new wireless router.
I am curious, because I noticed you had the discovery courses, the first couple of them, and wondered why you hadn't gone on with 3 and 4 of discovery.
Yeah, just give me a second, Robert. I just had somebody ask me a question. I'll be with you in a sec. Why didn't we go on to Discovery 3 and 4? Because we thought... I have to edit my own recordings. I'm going to have to be politically correct about this. I'm not very happy with the Discovery courses. I don't believe that the Discovery courses cover the depth of knowledge that the Exploration courses cover. And I tended to find that the this Discovery courses were fairly simplistic. And basically, Discovery 1 and 2 are equivalent to Exploration 1. So it was thought that maybe it would be more efficient to offer students Exploration 1 than it would making them pay whatever it is, dollars for Discovery 1 and 2 and doing two semesters. I realise the Exploration's a bit high-paced, which is why we're still running the Discovery 1 lectures. But one of the things I would suggest to people, and this is purely optional, if you are having trouble understanding the exploration material, a couple of resources are available to you. One is to Skype me up and say, yeah, all right, Drongo, now what were you actually trying to tell us? And I'll be like, oh, okay, I'll explain this in a different way for you. Me being the Drongo, not you, of course. Or perhaps you could grab down some of the Discovery lectures. Now, there's an entire series that's been done by Elise and Jackie, which are this year's series. But prior to that, there are actually 3 semesters of Discovery done by yours truly. So if anybody would like to listen to the Discovery material, because they think it might be a sort of a toe in the water of networking rather than being chucked in the deep end, that resource is open to anybody who wants to pull those lectures down. The Discovery curriculum has not changed in the last 3 or 4 semesters, and it might be good intro material for the exploration. If I was a used car salesman, I would be trying to sell you Discovery 1 Module 5, which I do a whole lot of the binary and subnetting stuff on. And there's actually, according to Grace, who reckons that my Module 5 Part 3 of last year's Discovery was the best subnetting lecture she's ever heard. I don't know how true that is. But all of those lectures are up on the site, and whilst I do understand that people have got better things to do than listening to all of our lectures all day, you might be able to high-speed a couple of them and chuck them on your audio player of choice and get a different perspective on the notes that you otherwise wouldn't have got from this series of exploration. But that said, if anybody has any suggestions in how I could improve these lectures or different ways in which I could deliver stuff, I'd be more than happy to hear from you guys, because I don't want to turn into one of these old dinosaur teachers that can't teach anyone anything because the stuff they were delivering would have been really great 15 years ago. Okay, so does anybody have any questions, queries they'd like to raise? No, seriously, if there's anything that people think that could be redone or anything that could be changed, we're really happy for constructive criticism or even constructive... you know, input and stuff that people might want to see differently.
I'd even say top 5.
Yeah, all right. I'll give you extra marks on your labs, all right?
Oh, thank you. I need those.
All right, so has anybody got any queries, questions, things they want to talk about before I get started on the Module 9 information? Anything they want me to clarify or work through? How's everybody finding the course so far? Anybody want to expand on that? Anybody learnt anything? Oh, okay, Pranav, set your audio devices in Ventrilo back to your default sound cards, and on all three checkboxes, check the Use Direct Sound button, and that should bring it back. You may have to sort of set your microphone and then and make sure the volume's raised, but then that should get you back on and able to talk. Maybe.
I guess I just don't know how much I'm learning, how much I'm retaining, but I think that that's my own fault because I haven't done any exams, so.
Well, it's important that you do the tests when they go up because that is a good benchmark on how much you know, and it's what we use to see how much we think you actually know from the chapters. So if you want to do some of those exams at some point, that would probably help you have some idea as to how much you actually remember.
I would say that the having done two discovery courses here at the local technical college, and now having gone through well over half of the exploration course, that the exploration is a much more seems like more theoretical kinds of stuff. We're getting into a lot of theory that Discovery simply didn't bother with, and I don't know whether the third and fourth courses of Discovery went back and picked that up, but seems like a lot more kind of theory, and some of it's just a little abstract.
Well, yeah, I'd agree with that. I think, but one of the things you've got to keep in mind is there are always two ways of looking at it, and you'll always get people arguing whether the theoretical approach is better or whether the practical approach is better, and you'll always have the practicalers and the theoreticalers, and they're not even words, but hey, it's my second coffee. I think the problem is that you've got to understand some of the theory to be a good network technician. It's okay to be an okay network technician, and you'll fix 90% of the problems that you'll see by looking at the lights, pinging the default gateway, and going through the actual, you know, troubleshooting process of other lights on, other cables connected. But when you get some really interesting problems like web pages half loading and MTU mismatches and that sort of thing, that's where the theory really comes into its own. And I agree there might be a bit much theory in exploration. It just depends on how you look at it. But I started with networks in 1995, and if I hadn't read as much theory as what I had up until now, I don't think I would be as able to troubleshoot the wide degree of network problems that I've troubleshot over the years. And not blowing my own trumpet, and I do actually own a trumpet, ironically enough. I find that being very theoretical and being grounded in the actual way that these things function does help a lot in the diagnostic process, especially when it comes to really tracking down what's going on the really hard-to-fix problems. But Discovery will allow you to solve 90 to 95% of your network problems. And to answer your question, no, it does not pick up in the theory later in the course.
I guess I find it pretty helpful. I tend to be more practical because I've actually done a lot of this stuff for a long time. But I was like Carrie. I read a lot of books, you know, that I got various places, you know, Teach Yourself TCP/IP in 7 days, that was 700 pages of some pretty theoretical stuff, but it gets immensely useful when you get into things like how come my VoIP isn't behaving, and how come I can't route from here to there, and how to troubleshoot DSL that's super slow on one router and fast on another. So it's actually, this theory stuff is actually quite useful. I mean, I'm not an real expert by any stretch. It's sort of been 12 years of practical experience.
Well, I wouldn't put my hand up to be an expert either. I'm more of a drip under pressure, but generally speaking, it's just been experience and things that we've had to track down over the years at people's places and network installations that have taught us you know, how these things work, and also, you know, read a lot of theory and that sort of thing. And I'm hoping that once the labs come through, there'll be some more practical stuff on the remote bundle that you guys will actually get to get your hands dirty, and that may actually cause the theory to drop into place. The mixer in Ventrilo, Pranav, should be set to... I don't have a mixer line set. I just have it set to using the default sound cards and stuff, so I'm not sure what's going on there. No, the mathematics doesn't get it much more complicated than what we've done so far. It's basically binary and subnetting.
That's one comment. I never understood subnetting as well as when we did it here. I mean, I sort of kind of got the theory, but I tended to cheat and use automated calculators. And now I can actually do it in my head.
Mm, and that can be useful. It can also be useful for estimate cross-checking the answers on the calculators as well. If you put the wrong numbers into the calculators, you get the wrong numbers out, and you'll tend to find that if you see something that comes up on the calculator that looks a bit odd, and you've got some idea how it should fall out, you sort of go, hang on. Oh, no, that's what I wanted. And I do occasionally use IPCalc, which is a Debian package, a Ubuntu package, to do my subnet calculations. Also, the Shorewall firewall has an IPCalc mode in it. And if you're not running Linux, you can ignore that last bit. But they will actually do the calculations for you on the masks and stuff as well. And it means that you've got some idea as to whether the answers you're getting out of the calculators and stuff are actually relevant and match your network situation. Yes, the final exam is online. Basically, we would like to have people sit on Ventrilo while they do the final exam where possible. And we try to strongly recommend that. And in fact, we can do the final exam during lecture time if that's something we need to do. So that if you get into trouble or there's a diagram description that you don't know, whatever, we can help you with it. But if circumstances cause you not to be able to do the final exam in that time window, then yes, we will let you do it at home like you've done all the other chapter exams. Okay, now somebody had a question about switches, I think. Or am I imagining? Okay, so did anybody have any questions about switches? And I was also going to say to Pranav, if you may have to close and reopen Ventrilo to get your sound cards to switch back across properly. I'm not sure. So
if you're using
you
Windows
try.
7, make sure that the Ventrilo volume and the volume mixer hasn't like set itself at zero, because I've had that happen before.
That only works for playback, though, doesn't it? Like, that's only for playback, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know, actually. Probably. That's true.
Okay, yeah, okay. Well, I'd check make sure your microphone's set back to your microphone. You have a question on switches. Do you want to mess around with your audio for another? Yeah, there is a test in setup, and if you go into setup, you won't be able to talk to us. So if you're in the setup dialogue, you can't mic up, but that's something that... if you go test with test, it'll actually test whether you're actually transmitting and receiving, which may... Okay, well, it's up to you whether you want to type your question on switches or whether you want to mess around a bit for another few minutes and then ask for the question. Oh, I'm good at carrying on, don't you worry. Okay, I can do that. Anybody else have any questions on anything that they want to talk about? Preferably course-related. Obviously, we will certainly not be advertising things like Drew's Let's Play of Shades of Doom, which you can get your hands on and listen how to get through the Shades of Doom game. But yeah,
thank you for not advertising that. I appreciate it. Because this is serious. Yes.
Well, so it's Shades of Doom, isn't it?
Yeah. I finished it. I'm trying to upload the last part, but QAudio is being a pain.
Fair enough. No, he's checking stuff.
Oh, I thought that was you going down again.
No, I'm still here for the moment. All right. I suppose I'll start on Chapter 9 stuff. All that sort of goodness. Now, the other thing was, don't forget, guys, you guys can Skype me out of class hours, and I think I've got voicemail on my work Skype. I'll just check, because if I don't, I'll go put that on after lecture, of course. Okay, doesn't seem to want to tell me whether I've got it or not, so I have to check that up on Skype.com later. But if anybody wants my home Skype, to catch me at some times when I'm not actually in at work, because I realize availability is going to be a problem for some people. You can do one of two things. You can either email me for my home Skype, or you can email me and I will make myself available on my work Skype for you at a predetermined time. and I'm quite happy to do that.
Alrighty.
And I'm sure everybody here has all played with Skype 5 and the new Facebook integration. Ain't that cool?
I haven't heard about Skype 5.
Came out...
And I hate Skype, so...
Came out last week. There are some scripts available for it from Doug Lee's website. And one of the new things it has is Facebook integration, if you happen to be on Facebook, which unfortunately I am. And it will show you your newsfeed in a nice little heading level 3 thing where you can jump to the... You just press H to jump to the next news item and you can comment and like and unlike stories and stuff.
Or the number 3.
Or the number 3, yes. This is assuming you're using JAWS, of course. Other screen readers, YMMV.
Yes.
Yes, I think the accessibility in Skype 5 is actually slightly better than previous versions. They've done a lot of work on the screen reader mode.
It's a great deal better.
Yeah, you can actually paste phone numbers into the call thing and stuff, which is kind of handy. Yeah.
You don't even really need scripts anymore. So now I only hate Skype because it's bloated.
Well, sometimes you do need scripts because the scripts will allow you to do things, for example, like press Alt-1 twice and then that will pop your chat messages into a virtual buffer from where you can cut and paste messages and stuff, which can sometimes be useful. Okie dokie. All right. Pranav hasn't come back yet, so we won't get his question on switches. All right, I'm going to start on the stuff for chapter 9. Unless anybody's got any other things they want to ask, and silence is golden, as it has been previously, you can either ask before I get to turn on my autovox or harass me a bit later. Okie dokie. Chapter 9 of Exploration deals with Ethernet. I've been through a bit of this last week, but I'm going to whiz through it again because... Oh, somebody's tapping a microphone or something. Okay. So I've gone through a bit of this last week, but I'm... Yeah, that's working. Okie dokie. So the original Ethernet standard was done in 1980. Digital Equipment, Intel, and Xerox. This was expensive gear. Back in 1980, you could be paying up to $1,500 per Ethernet card. And, you know, thick coax, 10Base 5, which had the vampire taps that would screw into the cable and stuff, you could be looking at, you know, $5 or $6 a meter. I'm not sure what coax prices were back in 1980. Does anybody know? I'm not quite old enough to know that.
Back in 1980, coax was $1,500.
Yeah, well, that'll do. Well, I don't know what it was, right? But it was probably more expensive than what it is now. So in 1985... IEEE standard 802.2 and 802.3, and they made a few changes to the standard. Okay, does your audio work yet, Pranav, or you haven't got to testing it yet? Okie dokie. Now, as we spoke, the data layer is subdivided into two layers, the 802, the LLC, or the logical link control, and the media access control. The media access control is responsible... is responsible for figuring out how you're going to get access to the media, whether we're using CSMA CD or whether we are using CSMA CA or another contention method. We spoke about CSMA CD before being carrier sense multiple access with collision detection, and we will talk about it more later on in the module. Okay, layer one is the physical voltages, the bits on the wires and the cable, and the type of cable we are using. That is obviously OSI layer 1. We are using the OSI reference model here because the TCP layer, just the TCP IP model, just has a network access layer which doesn't cover the finer points of the access layers like the OSI model doesn't. The MAC sublayer handles the physical components, i.e. the network cards and the transceivers and all that sort of good stuff. Good morning, Curtis.
Good morning.
Now, if I remember correctly, you're not officially in this course, you're listening. So, that's right, isn't it?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, all good. Here we go. I wish more of our students would do that. It would save them a lot of grief when they get into the courses if you listen to the course first and see whether you like it. So, it's all good. The logical link control layer remains the same across all of your different media types. Not much changes in the logical link control. This refers to your Ethernet frame structure, where the target MAC addresses are, the source MAC addresses, the length type field, the frame check sequence, all that sort of good stuff. That stays the same. The good thing about that staying the same is that it makes Ethernet pretty much media independent. You can run Ethernet across 10 meg coax, or you can run it across 10 gigabit fiber. Now, layer 1 cannot communicate with the upper layers. It can't identify devices because it's only bit streams. Cannot determine the source of a transmission when multiple devices are transmitting because it doesn't know about the address stuff that's up in the logical link control layer. Layer 2 functions. It connects to the upper layers using logical link control, so the framing is what gets the stuff up to layer 3, which of course is the network layer, using the logical link control and the framing and all the Ethernet good stuff. It uses addressing scheme to identify devices. Can anybody tell me what sort of address does Ethernet use to identify a device?
The MAC address.
Yes, the MAC address. A 48-bit MAC address. Okay, and as we previously discussed, the first 24 bits of the MAC address refer to what?
The vendor.
The vendor of the network interface card. And the last 24 bits are a serial number that are assigned by the vendor themselves. And I think... I did some JAWS cursoring in Wireshark. I think Wireshark actually has a fairly complete vendor mapping table and will tell you who made the particular network card based on the MAC address prefix. It depends on how much running around you're doing with Wireshark, I suppose. You can also do it with... I don't know whether I spoke about the merits of this program last week, and if I did, I'm going to talk about it again this week. Has anybody here played with ARPWatch under Linux? Okay, I'll take that as a big fat no. ARPWatch is a daemon that sits in the background and it watches the ARP traffic on a particular interface, and then when you get changes and new MAC addresses and stuff pop up on the network, it emails you and tells you what the changes are. So basically what you can do is how many people have brought a machine onto their network and then gone scrabbling through their logs looking for the DHCP log fragment to actually find out what IP address it got assigned. Well, with ARPWatch you don't have to bother because ARPWatch will have already emailed you telling you that a new MAC address has popped up on your network and that it's assigned to a specific IP address. So we like ARPWatch a lot. It saves a hell of a lot of time, and it also is a good catch-all. So, I mean, most of you will have secured wireless networks, but if a MAC address comes onto your network that you don't know about, you know about it as soon as it talks to one of the routers or something. It's like, bang, on came that MAC address, and you know about it. So, it's all good. And it also means you can track, it's an easy way to get hold of MAC addresses and stuff if you're adding them into allow tables and deny tables and stuff. So, ARPWatch has got my vote of confidence. The other utility I use under Linux, which is very useful for firewalls, is a thing called fail-to-ban, which basically bans particular IP addresses if they fail to authenticate a number of times against your SSH port. So basically what happens is if you get 4 or 5 tries from a particular host to authenticate on SSH, it'll lock them out for an hour. That's really nifty. And it's a good thing to protect against denial of service attacks. But unfortunately this is a module on Ethernet, not a module on Linux, as much as I would love to teach a Linux course. So the layer 2 functions. Connects to the upper layers via logical link control. Uses addressing schemes, we covered that. Uses frames to organize bits into groups. Remember, the layer 2 PDU is frames. We have data, segments, packets, frames, bits, being the various PDUs down the OSI reference model. With data being at layer 7, which is the application layer, the transport layer being the segments, the network layer being the packets, the data link layer being the frames, and the physical layer being the bits. Anybody got a problem with any of that? Because that's all pretty heavy OSI stuff. And it uses media access control to identify transmission sources. Now, the 802.2 standard defines the LLC, and the 802.3 standard does the media access control stuff. Often when you look at the specs on a box that contains a switch or whatever, you will often see supports 802.3U, supports 802.3 whatever, supports, and that's probably to make the switch look really good. But if you have some idea as to what those standards are, then you will have some idea as to what the capabilities of the switch happen to be. Okay, so the LLC... Sorry, go ahead.
You get layer 3 switches too, don't you, these days?
And your audio is back. What was the problem out of morbid curiosity?
The microphone switch on the headset.
Okay. I'm going to have to tell Grace. She will be absolutely gratified that she's not the only one that does that. And I've done it too, just to be fair. You just forget that it's switched off. there are layer 3 switches. The reason there are layer 3 switches is because people want to do nifty things with packets. And as quality of service and stuff becomes more important, the capabilities of the switches blur into the router domain. So I think as I discussed last week, there are 3 types of switches. There is store and forward, which is what most of your cheap switches that you get from wherever are. They receive a whole packet, verify the packet, and then shovel it out to the port that that packet needs to go to or to the other ports on the switch. You then have cut-through switches, which look at the packet up to the destination MAC address, figure out where the packet is going based on the destination MAC address, and then shovels the rest of the packet through to the target very quickly. And then you have fragment-free, and I can't remember quite what fragment-free does, but I think Google would probably tell me if I went and looked it up.
I think it was similar to store and forward, where it kept storing and shoveling the packet across. Because he's there in one of the lectures, I'm trying to remember which, but you did cover this.
Yeah, I don't remember actually knowing what fragment free was, because I'm sure I would have remembered that. Hang on, I've got a web browser, and go to the homepage, give me Google, give me a definition on fragment free switching. Yeah, come on, tell me about it. Ah, okay. Wikipedia, thank you. Fragment-free, I have a braille display here. Fragment-free is a switch forwarding method. Fragment-free will hold the frame until the first 64 bytes are read from the source to detect a collision. So that's what fragment-free is. Now, that wasn't meant to show how ignorant I am, although that was certainly successful, but that was also meant to show how an IT person needs to be really quick on the uptake and be really good at research. So that's how you look stuff up in a hurry. So yeah, it receives the first 64 bytes, makes sure that there isn't a collision on the media, and then shovels the packets out that way. So that's what fragment-free does. Just out of morbid curiosity, are people still using Google natively, or have we all jumped across to ResearchIt in JAWS? I've never used ResearchIt myself, but I'm just wondering whether anybody puts it in common use.
I
use Google natively, didn't know there was another way.
Okay, yeah, you can do it with, you can do it with ResearchIt. I don't know why you would, but you can. I'm a bit concerned with this ResearchIt stuff because whilst I think in theory it's a good idea to have these ResearchIt plugins for the screen reader, I ask the question as to when are our young blind children actually going to use the internet as it actually is rather than having the interfaces to it insulated from them. But that's a discussion for another time. Now, the other thing this Wikipedia article is telling me about fragment-free switching. Great, this Wikipedia. It's only useful if you're interested in fragment-free is only useful if you've got a fully switched network. You're not going to get collisions anyway, so it's not necessary on those. The other thing about cut-through switching, and there's an article on that in Wikipedia, which I'm not going to pull open and read anyway, because you guys are all capable of reading Wikipedia yourselves, are forwarded before any checksums can be calculated. So cut-through is a high-speed switching mechanism. It's really designed to get through things through extremely quickly, because obviously the more switches you run packets through, the more latency you're going to get. So you get high latency and high integrity of store and forward, and the low latency and reduced integrity of cut through. So it's one of the middle switching methods.
So where would you use that? I mean, why would I want something which didn't do the error checking?
Well, it depends on how fast you want the packets to go through your network. Whenever you run packets through a switch, you're always going to see some degree of latency. You're going to see exceedingly low latency with cut-through switching. You're going to see a medium amount of latency with fragment-free, and you're going to see a much higher latency with store and forward if you have to wait for the full packet to be received and then be retransmitted.
Yeah, but is that perceptible to a human? I mean, does it really matter whether my packet comes to me in 1 microsecond or in 5 microseconds? Or is it a matter of scale?
Well, if you've got 30 machines that are all sending packets through, it may make a difference as to how quickly those packets are going through and whether those packets are being held up and stuff. I mean, it's certainly not going to make a difference in how fast Facebook loads for you on your particular workstation, but as the network loads increase and once you start doing things such as VLANs and packet switching with complexity on the network, any reduction in latency could be important if you've got other things that are introducing latency into the equation, especially on heavy loaded high bandwidth networks.
Okay, that kind of makes sense.
Anyways, now did I answer your switching question, or was there a different question you had on switching?
No, I had a very fundamental question on switches, which is that, okay, my packet comes through, it's got a MAC address, great. I've got a switching table, fantastic. But how does the switch know which port to send it to? I mean, a switch to me is a box with a power adapter, lights, and a hole. So how does it know which hole to send it to? Do the ports have addresses, or is this something hardwired in the circuit board? Or there's a cute little XOR or something going on somewhere?
Ah, okay. Basically, what happens with a switch is, a switch has, say, 4 or 8 ports or whatever. We'll just assume that it's got 4 just for our example. It has constant address memory. So what you basically have is you have, say, well, it depends on how much RAM you've got in the switch. Let's say you've got 512 kilobytes of RAM. And basically what happens is you split that RAM into 4, and you basically say, well, the first quarter of it is for port 1, the second quarter is for port 2, all the way through to port 4. And then you, as the MAC addresses come through, the source MAC addresses come through the logic, it then dumps the MAC addresses into the quarter of the memory that is for that particular port, so that when the switch needs to actually send a packet out to a particular port, it can do a very fast lookup on that constant address memory and go, ah, that's on port 3. Blam. But the thing you've got to remember about switches is that the first time a packet comes from a source port and is destined to an unknown destination, it is forwarded to all other switch ports except for the source port. And then, once the switch knows what port the target is on, it will then be forwarded specifically to that port that the target belongs to.
Ah, now that's intriguing. So, I mean, this is something like how ARP does the resolution, right? It sends out a broadcast. So this would be, I imagine, a MAC-level broadcast.
Yes, it is. And in fact, the ARP who has is a packet that will teach the switch where the source of a particular packet is, because you're saying ARP who has whatever. Then you are, then you can actually learn where the target is, based on, you know, the reply that comes back from that ARP who has.
Okay, then that's good.
Okay, back to the... anybody else got anything they want to talk about before we continue on? Otherwise, I'll go back to the note outline I've got here. Oh, the other thing I was going to ask, has anybody noticed lately, I don't know how many of you actually download the recordings of the lectures, I've started normalizing down to minus 16 dB rather than minus 10. Has anybody found that better or worse, or has nobody even noticed? And if nobody's noticed, that's fine. But it should make the lectures a little bit quieter and less pegged towards the top of the dynamic range.
I heard them, but I didn't quite notice. I did listen to... which one did I listen to? Oh, yeah, the one which had three parts. I think that was 6, 1, 2, and 3.
It sometimes there's a lot to talk about. I've just normalized them down a bit further, just to give people a bit more headroom on them. We did look at increasing the sample rate and bandwidth on the Ventrilo server. I mean, it is a bit hissy and stuff at its current settings, but given the fact that it only uses 1,800 bytes per second, we can't really complain about that. Okie dokie. LLC functions include making the connection with the upper layers, in other words, getting the packets up to the network layer, framing the network layer packet. This packet's been framed. I'm sure that's not what is said on an Ethernet all the time. I once went and saw Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and I will never get that 2 hours of my life back. Identifying the network layer protocol, remaining relatively independent to the physical equipment. Okay, so it's the stuff that is responsible for putting the packets from the network layer into frames that will be sent over the Ethernet. Now, I've spoken
this is
about...
the field that determined the upper layer protocol? I can't remember. You had a bit set or something.
There's a length slash type field. If the length slash type field is less than 600 hex or 1,500 decimal, then it is the length of the packet, which is what the field was used for in the PDIX standard of Ethernet, whereas if it's greater than 600 hex, it refers to the protocol that's traveling on the Ethernet, such as IP, IPX, NetBUI, etc.
Ah, thanks.
There we go. Sorry, I was just tidying up. Aardvark just tried to ask me a question, so I just had to tell it I was busy. Has anybody played with Aardvark?
I thought that was an animal of some kind.
It is. It's also often something that everybody called Aaron gets called, because their names both start with AA, so Aaron the Aardvark. But it's also a system where you sign up to it and you add it into one of your messengers. I think they've got a Skype contact, they've got an MSN contact, they may even have a Twitter contact now, I'm not sure, I'd have to go and have a look. And basically you ask it a question, and it puts the question out into the Aardvark network, and then somebody answers your question to the best of their ability, and it's good for getting answers to questions that aren't easily Googleable and stuff, like what is the best restaurant in Delhi or something, you'll get an answer to that sort of question, whereas Google might not find you that sort of answer easily. And then you can also set a preference on what sort of questions you're interested in answering, and then questions come through from time to time, and you can answer them to help other people out on Aardvark. So it's kind of a bit of fun, and definitely a good resource if all of your personal network is off on holiday or something. You can sort of fire out a question to Aardvark and sometimes get useful answers.
How do you spell it?
AARDVARK, and I will just type that into chat. There we go, Aardvark, www.aardvark.com. I think it's actually www.vark.com will get you there as well, V-A-R-K. I will just check that. Yes, www.vark.com will get you to Aardvark. Looks like they're now owned by Google now, like everything else. All right, anyway, but it's quite useful. I use it for it's. I actually find it good for cooking advice. I was asking about how to slow cook chicken, and there were people who were able to tell me that sort of thing, which was probably Googleable as well. But it is a nifty network to be able to throw a question out there and get answers to things. Anywho, we talked about the various medias last week. 10 base 5, thick net coax with vampire taps that screw into the cable, terminated at both ends, 500 metres maximum single segment length. 10 base 2 was thin net, easier to twist around corners. You don't see a lot of it these days. 50 ohm coax. No, you cannot use the same stuff for your television unless you're only running at very short distances, and I would strongly recommend against it because television coax is 75 ohms.
Okay, hang on. Mm-hmm. 50 ohms coax, then you're talking about resistance here, if I'm not mistaken.
Impedance.
Impedance, is it? Okay, got it.
Impedance is resistance as it applies to AC, except it's got more funky bits that go with it because it's alternating current and you've got things like backwards EMF and various other quirky things of alternating current that don't apply to direct current. So that's sort of the AC version of resistance. That's horribly oversimplified, but that's about as much as I understand about impedance. It gets really complicated.
Okay. Not what I did in grade high school, but good to know.
Then you've got 10 base 2, as I said, 185 metres maximum length. And the reason these things have maximum lengths, part of it is the signal will attenuate and get interfered with if it goes through enough cable. So you get the signal dropping off to where it becomes indistinguishable. But especially with a distance level of 500 meters, given the timing constraints of Ethernet, which we talk about later on in this chapter, it actually takes a significant amount of time for the packet to get from one end of the coax to the other, and especially if you've got multiple segments and stuff, it can affect how and when collisions and stuff are detected. And then you've got 10 base T, which is certainly one of the most popular networking medium, which can have a single run of a maximum of 100 meters. That means 100 meters between your workstation and the switch. So if you had like a workstation, 100 meters of cable, a switch, and another 100 meters of cable, the cable run distance starts again from the next port on the switch. And then you've got 1000 base CX, which apparently can go for 25 meters. And you can also have gigabit fiber. Now, one of the things, and gigabit twisted pair. Now, one of the things you've got to understand about gigabit twisted pair is that the maximum length of gigabit twisted pair is 100 meters, but you need Cat5e, Cat6, or Cat7 cable to run it. If you run it on regular Cat5, it will work, it just won't be as effective. Has anybody listened to our cable testing lab? We did a cable testing lab a couple of years back. I don't know if everybody's found it and listened to it.
It had songs.
Oh, yeah, we were all singing. We were singing the color codes, weren't we?
Yeah, they have a table in there in the chapter with color codes. Orange is matched to some pin and some other pin.
I have memories of green, white, green, blue, white, blue. Oh, why did you have to remind me, Drew?
Sorry. I didn't know those memories were painful.
Oh, we don't sing anymore. We're all serious and stuff now. So we used to sing, though, in the early days of Cavi. We used to sing songs about different aspects
of network. Oh, for the days when one could sing.
Well, I don't know. I think some of the students are secretly happier about the fact that we don't sing now, and that's okay. Sometimes I do, though. I have a relapse.
I can try and do a remix if you want, so to the Lollipop song.
Yeah, that's entirely up to you.
Okay.
But essentially, I'll make sure that is in the exploration area. I will symlink it in, and I would suggest that people have a listen to that cable testing lab. There's a couple of them. There's a newer one where Ian makes some broken network cables, and we test them. And then there's an older one that we did in Curtin, which has got the songs in it. No, actually, the songs are in the cable making lab. I don't think the songs are in the cable testing lab. But that will give you a good idea as to how you make and test cables. So would anybody like me to simlink those into exploration area so you guys can find them? Otherwise, you've got to go into
By
discovery and find them.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea.
Okie dokie. Then there's another one where you get to hear us pull apart hard disks and stuff, but that's in the ITE1 area, and Ian actually snags his fingers between the two hard disk magnets, which is probably the most exciting bit of the whole recording. Okay. The MAC layer encapsulates data. The data encapsulation provides three primary functions. Frame delimiting, in other words, where do frames start and end, addressing, and error detection. Now, the MAC addresses are added to the frames at this particular layer, and the frames are shown, the start and end of frames are shown based on the preamble, and the signaling on the actual wire tells it where the frames start and end. The CRC, or the frame check sequence, is sent at the end of the frame, and it is designed so that you can detect errors in the frames. If anybody really cares, I have this really good document called Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About CRCs and Were Afraid to Ask. And it actually goes through exactly how CRCs work. But boy, oh boy, it's a heck of a read. But anyway, the CRC is a number that is calculated based on the contents of the frame, and it is compared at the receiving end, and if the numbers differ, then there is a high probability that the packet has been corrupted, and the packet is then dropped, and then an upper level protocol will retransmit the frame. Ethernet is popular because it has the ability to. It has simplicity and ease of maintenance, ability to incorporate new technology, so we can go all the way from thick net coax all the way through to 10 gigabit fiber. Reliability, it generally works really, really well. I'm one of these old-fashioned people who would really prefer to hook my machine into the Ethernet because it is more reliable than wireless. Has anybody had wireless dropouts?
Oh, yes. I've had horrible fluctuation with wireless. And then there's, of course, the story of my wireless adapter, but that is for a later time.
Fair enough. That's why when you're on wireless, you install a copy of Free Download Manager, because you just about have to have it, or run Firefox's Integrated Download Manager. Wireless isn't as reliable as cabled Ethernet, but it is certainly very convenient if it works for you. Low cost, relatively speaking, of installation and upgrade. And that's important, because if you're putting in a lot of Ethernet and stuff, you don't want it to be horrendously expensive. Frames remain the same across all of the types of Ethernet, physical, copper, etc. So in other words, you don't have to muck with the frames at layer 2. They stay pretty much untouched across the different types of media. We spoke about the Aloha network on the Hawaiian Islands, which was used to send radio messages between the different Hawaiian Islands. Apparently they don't grow pineapple in Hawaii anymore. Basically you would listen to see if there was no signal. If there was no signal, you would then send a message out to a station, and then the station would actually reflect that message back to make sure that it had been received. So it wasn't very efficient, but it was very handy if you lived on the islands of Hawaii. The original Ethernet used a shared bus topology. In other words, all of the signals travelled down the same cable so everybody could see the packets that were being transmitted. If you had a sniffer running, you could see whatever packets turned up on the coax. I built my first Ethernet in 1995, and I had two machines, and I had a big long piece of coax running from one side of the bedroom to the other, two T-pieces and two terminators, and I spent 3 days trying to figure out why the Ethernet wasn't working. The two machines could not ping each other, and I went through every single thing that I could think of, and I was getting an error from one of my NI5210 cards, which said, TDR reflection test fail, error 3 clocks away. I'm like, oh, I don't know what that means. So I took it down to the local computer store and found out that I actually had a short in my coax right near the end where one of the connectors was put on. And then we fixed that up, put a new connector on the end of it, a new BNC connector on. And after that, my 10 megabit Ethernet worked absolutely brilliantly. So I don't know whether anybody's had any experience with coax networks, but one break in the cable will bring the entire network down. The problem with the physical bus was that as the number of devices increased, you had contention problems, and when you started getting lots and lots of collisions on the media, you would have a non-graceful degradation of performance as network utilization improved, increased. So as you got over 60% utilization, things got really bad. Now, a hub sits between a number of devices, usually running twisted pair, and it concentrates the signal and uses a star topology. However, it is a physical star and a logical bus. In other words, a hub takes a signal from one port and sends it out to every other port on the hub. So you end up still with a physical star but a logical bus topology on your hub-based network. Anybody got any questions on that? Everybody understand that? Alrighty. As collisions increased, performance dropped, and that's why people started putting switches onto networks, because switches would micro segment the network and limit the impact of the collisions. Modern installations, you probably want to be putting in 1 gigabit Ethernet or better. Otherwise, I would be asking why not. You can actually do Ethernet over, like, you know, 10, 15, 20 kilometres, 25 kilometres distances if you use fibre. And for situations where Ethernet is run between buildings, it's probably a good idea to use fibre, because otherwise you can have potential differences and lightning strikes hitting copper cables and stuff is not particularly cool.
What kind of reassurance do you get that you'll actually get gigabit speeds if you put in a gigabit network?
What do you get if you put gigabit speeds and if you get negative?
Guaranteed you get that you'll get gigabit speeds if you install a gigabit network.
It depends on the networking equipment you're using. If you're using cheap networking equipment or slow computers, you're probably not likely to get gigabit speeds, but I have seen reports on the net of optimized setups getting up close to 970 megabytes per second on gigabit networks. But to actually shovel that traffic out, you've got to have some very fast... you've got to be able to supply the network with data that fast. If you look at the speed you get out of most hard disks, you're probably not going to get a gigabit of speed out of most older hard disks. You probably will out of newer hard disks, but to actually get sustained data throughput, even off the hard disks and stuff, and running it through the I/O bus, you're going to see a certain drop-off in latency there. So you've got to make sure that the devices you're shoveling stuff over gigabit networks with can actually provide data fast enough to actually saturate the pipe. So does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah, kind of.
Well, the other thing you've got to understand is that Windows file sharing is usually pretty bad as far as speed is concerned. And if you're actually concerned about how fast your network's going, two of the things I would recommend doing under Windows 7 is, if you can, go in and turning off Home Group, because it slows everything down, and setting your encryption back to 56-bit from 128, because the 128-bit encryption does use a lot of CPU overhead, and it will actually slow network transfers down quite significantly.
Yeah, I just haven't seen a use for the home group thing.
It basically lets you set one password on the entire network sharey thing, and then it just shares out all these folders automatically for you. It's basically a turnkey share files out network solution that works on home networks without you having to configure anything.
I guess if I used the libraries, then it would mean something, but I don't, so...
No, it's not just libraries. It's regular shared public folders and stuff like that as well. It's just a... no user serviceable parts inside, sort of share stuff out in a safe manner sort of thing that Microsoft cooked up for people who really didn't understand how to do network sharing and permissions. Okay, so the minimum frame on Ethernet is 64 bytes. If you get a frame shorter than 64 bytes, it's considered a runt, and it should be discarded. Maximum frame size is 1,518 bytes. This includes all bytes from the destination MAC address through to the frame check sequence. The preamble and start frame delimiter fields are not included in those numbers, apparently. There's 1522 byte frames, which were standardized in 1998, which allowed you to put the VLAN ID in so that you could run multiple virtual local area networks on one physical set of LAN cabling. If the frame is outside these frames ranges, it has dropped, unless, of course, you are using jumbo frames, which can be quite large. Depending on the networking equipment, it is important to make sure that all of your network equipment can support jumbo frames, and that the that all of your network equipment supports jumbo frames of a particular size. I had some network cards that the maximum jumbo frames they could send and receive would be 3,072 bytes. So obviously, that's something to be aware of. Now, unicast frames go specific directly to a specific MAC address. MAC address for broadcasting at the layer 2 level is all ones. So it's 6 bytes of FF in the destination MAC address. There are certain things that use MAC level broadcasts. One of them is ARP who has requests. Another one is DHCP discover messages. They are usually broadcast out onto the network. DHCP discover messages are usually sent to the non-specific network broadcast of 255.255.255.255, whereupon they are answered by a DHCP server. Now, the multicast MAC address is weird. It basically begins with... Oh, move my piece of carrot cake out of the way, or I can't get to the Braille display. There we go. The multicast MAC address is a special value that begins with 01:00:5e in hexadecimal. The value and the lower 23 bits of the IP address of the multicast group is embedded into that address, so it's all a bit strange. And then the remaining 6 hexadecimal characters of the Ethernet MAC address. And the remaining bit is in the MAC address is always set to a 1. No, it's always set to a 0 even. So obviously that's quite complex, but basically that... Does everyone understand what multicasting is used for? Because it's an odd concept.
Well, that was for audio stuff, right? Video conferencing and things, if you were communicating to a bunch of people or something like that.
Yeah, it's... you can use it for audio, you can use it for video. One of the other things that multicast is used for is if you have, say, 30 workstations and a clone image, you can clone an image down onto 30 workstations at the same time with one set of multicast traffic. So that allows you to rebuild 30 lab machines by only sending a few gig of data across the network on a multicast thing, and that will cause the machines to all clone down from one set of network data. Ghost, I believe, was one of the first utilities to use multicast in this capacity. But there are also free alternatives such as CloneZilla that can use multicast, although as far as I know, CloneZilla is not accessible to the vision impaired at this stage. Okie dokie. A hub is known as a multi-port repeater because you basically put the signal in one port and it repeats out of all the other ports, so it's a multi-port repeater. The hubs and repeaters increase the size of the collision domain. The collision domain is the size of the network segment where collisions can occur. The bigger the collision domain, the more likely you are to have collisions if there are more machines active, and the more degradation in performance you can experience. When hubs are connected together, they create an extended star. Obviously, as the distances get longer, you've got higher latencies and you need to wait longer for collisions. If you don't detect a collision in the first 64 bits of the network frame, it's a late collision and they are basically undetectable and cause all sorts of trouble. The bit time on 10 megabit Ethernet is 100 nanoseconds. The bit times on 10 megabit Ethernet are 100 nanoseconds.
Could I detect a late collision using a sniffer? Would there be a change in what the packets look like?
That would be corrupted. The collision would actually cause the packets to be corrupted.
Oh, okay.
So late collisions will often show up as CRC errors or just weirdness, so malformed packets. So you want to avoid late collisions where possible. But in most modern networks, you're using switches, and most modern switches are full duplex, so collisions aren't as much of a problem as they once were. Okay, the bit time on 10 megabit Ethernet is 100 nanoseconds. The bit time on 100 megabit Ethernet is 10 nanoseconds. So 100 meg is 10 nanoseconds, and gigabit is 1 nanosecond. So not a lot of time to send bits through. You cannot have half duplex in 10 gigabit Ethernet. It's just not supported. It's expected that if you're running 10 gig Ethernet, you've got full duplex. Devices must wait 96 bit times between frames. This allows the media to settle and it allows transceivers and stuff to recover. Now, as we spoke, 10BASE-T uses... Manchester encoding over two twisted pairs, so it only uses four of the wires. 1, 2, 3, and 6 are the pins that it uses. The other wiring, 4, 5, 7, and 8, could be used for telephone wiring or other uses. The minimum category cabling you can use is Cat3, but most people put Cat5 in even if it is only running 10 megabit Ethernet, although that's generally a legacy installation. In the late 90s...
the category of a cable?
The category of the cable is determined by how many twists per meter, the quality of the wiring, and in the cases of Cat6 cable and Cat7, there is actually a plastic separator in the middle of the cable that keeps the pairs separated, and the category of the cable is usually written on the outside of the installation.
Got it.
In the late 90s, they standardized 100 megabit Ethernet. I don't know whether anybody remembers, but there was actually... two standards. There was VG AnyLAN, which was done by HP, and then there was also 100BASE-T. And it turns out that 100BASE-T won, and nobody knows about VG AnyLAN anymore. Basically, gigabit Ethernet is mind-bogglingly complicated. The transceivers are more complex, and I don't know whether it's still the case to a certain degree, but you'll tend to find that gigabit gear is... more expensive than 100 megabit gear. This is probably also worth mentioning as well. If you buy a $20 gigabit card, it would be possibly foolish to expect the same performance out of that card than if you bought a $50 gigabit card. So it is quite possible that if you buy a Realtek 8168 gigabit card off eBay for $5 or $6, that it may not achieve full gigabit throughput because the networking hardware just isn't that good. Okay, now we're talking about hubs and switches. Hubs force media to be shared, as we previously discussed. The more latency you get, the more hubs you add, the more latency you get. There was actually an old 3-4-5 rule that said no more than... three hubs or repeaters no more than three segments between four. What was it? I'm sure I remember what the 3-4-5 rule is. I'll have to look that up, but basically, you could have no more than five segments hooked together by hubs and repeaters. Otherwise, you would have too much latency and too much complexity. Now, the switch micro-segments the network, which decreases the latency. Reduces the collisions. There is some latency in a switch. However, depending on the type of switch will depend on how much latency you've got. You've got dedicated bandwidth for each port on a switch, collision-free environment, especially if the switch is operating in full duplex mode, full duplex operation, and that's all I have in the summarized notes at this point. Does anybody have any questions? Alrighty, let's do an impromptu quiz. So everybody into chat, let's find out how much you guys actually know. Question one. An IP address has the following number of bits. A, 24, B, 32, C, 40, or D, 48. And if you said B, you are absolutely correct. A MAC address has the following number of bits. A, 30, B, 40, C, 48, or D, 80. Excellent. The network with the subnet mask 255.255.255.0 is a class A, B, C, or D network. IPv6 has extended the number of hosts available on a network by having how many bits in its addresses? A, 64, B, 96, C, 128, or D, 256. And the correct answer is C, 128 bits in an IPv6 address. That's a lot of hosts. The formula for calculating the number of hosts available on a subnet is A, 2 to the power of H, where host H is the host bits, B, 2 to the power of H minus 2, where H is the number of host bits, C, 3 to the power of H, or D, 2 to the power of H plus 2. Ah, well done, guys. If subnetting a class C network using the subnet mask of 255.255.255.224, how many subnets could you have? And I'll give you guys a few seconds to work this out, because it may take a little while. Subnet mask of 255.255.255.224. And you're subnetting a class C, how many subnets could you have? Would anybody like a hint? We have one answer which is not correct. We have a class C subnet with 255.255.255.0. So can anybody tell me how many combinations can we have on a class C? 254, yeah, I'll take that. Or 256 combinations, because I said how many combinations can we have. Can anybody tell me how many hosts we would have on a network with a subnet mask of 255.255.255.224? Yeah, we can have 30
how many
hosts.
Subnets or last time, so I was confused.
Yeah, that's fine. No, that's fine. Okay, so if we have 30 hosts, or 32 combinations, because the network and broadcast address are a valid set of combinations. If we have subnets of with combinations of 32, how many subnets can we have if we have a class C network? And if it was me, I'd be dividing 256 by 32, and that would give me the right answer. Yes, you can have 8 subnets from a class C of 32 size subnet. Anybody want any clarification on that last question?
I could use some, yeah. I apparently don't understand what a subnet is. I clearly failed.
Well, remember how we said that on networks you have a certain number of bits allocated to the network portion, a certain number of bits allocated to the host portion. The subnet mask tells you how many bits are allocated to the network portion and how many bits are allocated to the host portion. The subnet mask of 255.255.255.224 basically tells you that you have 24 plus Let me see, 128, 64, 32. So we have 27 bits for network and 5 bits for host. Oh, I've just figured out a shortcut. If you were figuring out how many subnets you could have, if you worked out that we had a Class C subnet and you had 8 bits, and you knew for a fact that you had 5 bits in the 255.255.255.224 for subnetting, that would leave you 3 bits for subnetting, and 2 to the power of 3 is 8. So that would be the easy way to work that one out. Well, relatively speaking. Now, I do apologize, that was a bit of a nasty question to spring on you all for the last quiz question. But it did give me the idea that we certainly need a little bit more practice in the subnetting and how to break it down and stuff. But yeah, does that make any more sense, Drew? You've got to figure out how many bits are for your network, how many bits are for your host, and how many bits you're using for your subnetting. And once you know that, you can calculate how big the networks and stuff are going to be.
Well, how do you know? I mean, is it always going to be 2? Because I know that you're taking from 32, and there's 27 network bits, and there's 5. Like, how do you know, out of those 5, what bits are the subnet bits and what bits are the host bits?
Well, out of those 5 bits, the 5 bits are used for hosts. So the right-hand 5 bits are used for hosts. And then in our example, the 3 bits to the left of that we're using for subnetting. So you've got 0000. And then the bits to the left of that are actually the SuperNet bits that the network.
Okay, so the three bits that aren't in the octets are subnet bits.
Yeah, the right-hand 5 bits are used for host
section.
Yeah. You're borrowing 3 bits from the SuperNet. In other words, you're borrowing 3 bits from the Class C network to actually create your subnets, and then the 5 bits on the right-hand side are for your host bits.
I mean, I think what does help in this case is if you convert everything to binary before you even start solving the question. So whatever information you get, convert to binary. I'm not saying I've understood all of this, as clearly, but that's what has helped me to do a lot of the assignment questions. Everything to binary and then figure out all of this.
Yeah, look, there are multiple methods of doing it. Converting it all to binary certainly does make it easier. Once you understand how the subprocessors work, you can take shortcuts like I have, and you can actually then look at these things and look at them more holistically and figure out how they function comparatively speaking.
You know, the problem with some of this is the mechanics. I mean, did I write 25 ones or did I write 23 ones? So sometimes that it gets a little dicey, and I don't even know if there is a solution to something like that.
Well, one of the things I do, which helps me, because I realize it can be difficult to count them in JAWS and stuff, obviously. I'm lucky enough to have a Braille display, which certainly doesn't go for everyone, but if you have a Braille display, you can feel happy because it does make life a lot easier. When I write 25 ones, I usually write 8 ones, a space, 8 ones, a space, 8 ones, a space, and a 1. So that I'm very clear of, I do it in octet-sized chunks, and that means that it's less things for me to try and count up with eloquence going 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, because that's really difficult.
Oh, I did a version of that when I was trying to do the assignment, but I didn't put the space. Interesting.
Well, I tend to, because it shows me where the octet boundaries are. But the other thing that we recommend is if students have a pegboard, that makes it a lot easier too, because you can see the lines cut in the pegboard to show where the bytes divide. Unfortunately, pegboards are a bit big and heavy for us to ship, so you'd need to get somebody with a drill and a couple of bits of dowel to make you one up. But that makes subnetting a lot easier as well. We get the blinkies in the woodworking shop to make them up over here. They made us up a series of them. But unfortunately, because they're made of wood, we can't ship them internationally. All right. Anybody got any other questions before we finish up for... Everybody had enough quiz questions, by the way. Has anybody else got any other questions?
I would appreciate one more subnetting question just to redeem my awful earlier performance.
Oh, all right. If we are subnetting a class C network of 255.255.255.0 and we are using a subnet mask of 255.255.255.192, how many subnets could we have? You are absolutely correct, Melanie. Well done. So I'll just type that into chat. Class C subnetted with mask of 255.255.255.192. Now, do you have any idea, Drew, how Melanie came up with the number 4?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Would you like to either...
Let me try and work it out. 2 to the power... Well, because it would be 6... That would be 26 house bits and... or it's 26 network 26 bits, rather.
Network, yep.
Yeah, which would mean that you'd have 2 host bits and 2 subnet bits, and 2 to the power of 2 is 4.
Yes, that would be about right. You would actually have, 26 network bits, but you're using 2 of them for subnetting. Therefore, 2 to the power of 2 is 4. That's correct.
So imagine if it was a 255.255.255.0, then you would have 1 subnet bit. So you'd have 1 subnet.
Yeah, if you had 255.255.255.0, you would have 0 subnet bits, and 2 to the power of 0 is 1.
Yes.
Alrighty. Any other queries, questions, before we hit stop?